early.
Yeah.
But if that's not possible, so she simply says, I'm lighting candles without intention to accept Shabbos early. And Shabbos begins same time for everybody. But,
so you have to light candles at candle lighting time, and then you can expend...
No, it would actually be better for you to light candles later.
Uh-huh.
If you cannot start Shabbos within 18 minutes, then you light candles when you can start Shabbos. Assuming, of course, it has to be before sunset.
Now, you once said that it's better to daven mincha before you light candles?
Oh, yeah.
So can you push off the lighting candles and then make a transition to daven mincha?
If
you're still within it.
But I would say you should make it a matter of course, not to light within 5 minutes, and because clocks are not accurate, so... once you're within 5 minutes, and so just, at most, do not light after 13 minutes. Or less than 13 minutes before it sets up.
Rebbe, there's one more question. When you light candles, you need to pray, or you can postpone praying on the candle?
Which
the bracha?
Well, the bracha. Blessing on the candle, you recite, first you light the candle, then you cover your eyes, then you say the bracha. You have to say the bracha right after, right then. You don't say it later.
You can't say it later, okay.
No,
the only time you can do that is Yom Kippur. If you were going to Shul,
it's Rosh Hashanah.
No, one second. The question that Sarah raised is about reciting the bracha l'hadlik ner. So that's the same for Yom Kippur. Whatever you like, you have to say the bracha. Definitely. No, I was just saying that the ability to say that I'm lighting and I'm not accepting the Shabbos. I mean, you make the bracha, but you don't have to get. So that would be, if, for example, you have to drive to Shul afterwards, that would be a reason. But that doesn't defer the... That does not defer the blessing. You do say the blessing, l'hadlik ner, but you would not say the shechiyana, which is only for Yom Kippur. Yeah. So that's probably safe for saying something. Mm-hmm. Check one reference. No, I did. Just one gematria. Yeah, last night.
I just brought the day.
Rabbi, what if you go to shul from Mincha after you light candles?
Preferred. All right, so then you should light candles and have intention that you're not accepting shabbos. You light candles, have in mind that you're not accepting Shabbos. Are you talking about driving to shul or walking?
No, walking to shul, but doing mincha and shul.
Even so, you should not be mekabel Shabbos if you haven't gotten the mincha yet, because once you're mekabel Shabbos, you cannot daven mincha, because mincha is a weekday prayer. So if you are lighting candles and you're not mekabel Shabbos, then you can daven mincha after candle lighting. But if you're mekabel Shabbos, you would not daven mincha.
Is that the only thing you can do? I mean, you can't do malacha, can you? After you light candles and make the bracha?
If you're not makabel Shabbos, you can do malacha, yeah. I mean, you're not makabel Shabbos, I mean, it's not Shabbos. Well, it is if you didn't stipulate, but it is possible to make a condition that it's makabel Shabbos.
So is it a different to light on time and not be makabel and do the last few things that you have to do? Or is it a different to do the last few things and then light a little late?
I would say light a little late. Because it is better. It is better for the candle lighting to be your acceptance of Shabbos.
Perhaps if you forgot to turn off the other something that you had your husband do it between that when he had for your light.
Well, yeah, your husband did not accept. Your husband did not accept Shabbos.
Okay.
That's right. I'm sorry. Unfortunately, I have to leave a little earlier today, but we're continuing our discussion of the Maharal on Inyanim of Hanukkah. And essentially, the first two-thirds of the Sefer is not about Hanukkah directly, but the first two-thirds of the Sefer is about the four Malchios, the four kingdoms, the four Goliaths. And by the way, this is obviously a theme of Hanukkah generally. If you look at the song that we sing after the lighting of the candles, we sing Ma'os Sur. Not everyone sings Ma'os Sur. And most people, you know, know perhaps the first stanza by heart, but it's a long song. And the song spells the word Mordechai. Mordechai was the author of Ma'os Sur later. It's not the Mordechai of Purim, because that was before the story of Hanukkah. But if you look at Ma'os Sur, every stanza of Ma'os Sur refers to a particular golos. So, for example, the first stanza is a general stanza that Hashem saves us in times of adversity. The next stanza that begins, Ra'os Sava La Nafshi, my soul has suffered much evil, that is about Mitzrayim. That is about Mitzrayim. Yeah. Then you have the Dalit, Devir Kotsho Heviani, talks about the building of the Beis HaMikdash and the destruction of Nebuchadnezzar and Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel was the Jewish leader who brought the Jews back with Ezra to Eretz Israel. So you go from Mitzrayim to Babel. Then the next one talks about Haman, which is Paras. And then the Yud, of course, talks about the Hanukkah story itself, which is Yevanim Nikbetzu Alai. And that spells Mordechai, right, those stanzas. And then the fourth one is about the Golos that we're in today, which is the Golos of Edom. And that underwent, by the way, a lot of censorship. You may notice, maybe some of you are singing with your family and you have different some of the lines are different. Because some say, Mechei Pesha V'gam Resha, eradicate the evil and the sin of this empire. The evil, no, the phrase evil empire is not made up by Ronald Reagan describing the Soviet Union, but in fact it is the description of Chazal. So maybe Marshall Brieger or someone, you know, was one of the Jewish assistants gave him that phrase, I don't know. But the concept of Resha, and that was censored in the course of, the medieval period, when Rome was identified with the Catholic Church, there were changes that were made, and therefore most Siddurim do not have the phrase Mechei Pesha, but they say Dechei Admon, Betzel Salmon, Dechei Admon, push away Esav, etc. More of a less clear reference. But that is referring to the fourth exile. So it does turn out that the concept of connecting Hanukkah to all of the four Goliaths does emerge from the Ma'os Sur itself. And again, the point to remember is, therefore, that Hanukkah is a celebration of the downfall of Malchus Yavan, but the thing to keep in mind is that within the fourth Golos, we have elements of all the other Golos. So in particular, even though there's no Greek Empire, but to the extent that Yavan was a war against Kedusha, Yavan was a war not to destroy the body of the Jew, unlike Haman, but Yavan was a war to destroy the spiritual destiny of the Jew by elevating human intellect and human accomplishment as the highest form of what a human being could be, and refusing to submit to the yoke of heaven. That is, therefore, within Golos Edom, any pressures towards assimilation, ignorance, apathy, is Golos Yavan. So in effect, therefore, when Hanukkah celebrates the Nitzachon over the Golos of Yavan, it is the ability of the light of the Torah to overpower the assimilation, the ignorance, and the apathy that exists in the world. Right? That is what Hanukkah is about. The light overriding the darkness. So here the Maral makes a point, therefore, that Yavan's primary opposition was to the Torah and to the Beis HaMikdash itself. Unlike, for example, even the Babylonians, who really destroyed the Beis HaMikdash simply as a way to augment their conquest. They destroyed the temple so they would conquer us. Yavan had a specific agenda to destroy the holiness of the Beis HaMikdash. And there's, Maral says, there's even a gematria to this. Because the word for temple, for Beis HaMikdash, is Heichal, one of the words. It's called the Heichal. Now the gematria of Heichal is He, Yud, Chaf, Lamed. So what is that? He is 5, and Yud is 15, and Chaf is 35, and Lamed is 30. So the gematria of Heichal is 65. The gematria of Yavan is 66. Meaning to say that it was 66 is one more. It was Yavan's goal, as it were, to vanquish and override the holiness of the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash is 65. 66 is an attempt to be misgaber over the holiness of the Beis HaMikdash. But the Maral points out that this ignores the fact that in letters there are often hidden gematrios. And he says the following. This is a matter of diktik. Although the word heichal does have a yud, but in fact, whenever you have a tseire, tseire is an A sound, A. A tseire is in effect the vocalization of a yud as well. And therefore, although I would have thought that the yud that is there covers the yud that follows the tseire, but none of the Maral says that the tseire, the A sound, under the hay, represents a hidden yud, meaning to say, and yud of course is also the shame of Hashem, there is a hidden dimension of holiness that Yavan is not able to attack. And that is Merumas in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The hidden yud within the Heichal, right, the Heichal has two parts. Two-thirds of the Heichal is open, I mean it's open to Kohanim, that has the Mizbeach, well, the other Mizbeach is in the courtyard, but that has the Mizbeach of Ketores, of incense, it has the Shulchan, the table of the Lechem HaPanim, and it has the Menorah. And then when you enter the back third, that is the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The Kodesh HaKadoshim is hidden. Hiddenness represents an aspect of holiness that is so exalted that Yavan has no koach over that holiness. And that is Merumas in the hidden yud of the word Heichal that comes after the Tseire. And that is why the miracle of Hanukkah was done through oil that was sealed with the seal of the Kohen Gadol. Because the Kohen Gadol represents the person that is able to enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim one time during the year, and therefore that represents the element of holiness that is untouchable. And again, to bring it down to, obviously this is a very abstract idea, but to bring it down to our practical message, what it means is that the many levels of holiness that a Jew has can often be affected by the environment. Assimilation can take away many, many things that we have. But there is an innermost essence that is within the heart and soul of a Jew that in an ultimate sense never gets corrupted. That little jar that is sealed with the seal of the Kohen, which is represented by the Kodesh HaKadoshim, that only the Kohen Gadol can enter, that represents an essence within the Jewish soul that remains pure and holy. In Yiddish we call it the Pintel Yid, the little spark of the Jewish soul, which is not corrupted by Yavan. So the Yavan of the world can corrupt even the Heichal, but the Yavanim of the world cannot corrupt the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And that is the Shemen that is Munach, the Shemen that is sealed, the Chasamo Shel Kohen, Kohen Gadol. And
the Maral, yeah. Eben Ashtia was in the podium.
Yeah, during the second, actually, we should say, during the second Beis HaMikdash, and of course Hanukkah happened during the second Beis HaMikdash, there was no Aron HaKodesh. The Aron HaKodesh was hidden by Yoshiyahu before the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. And all there was the Eben Shasiyah, a stone. I mean, the stone was always there. They didn't put in the stone.
It's the center of the world.
Yeah, and the stone, and all of the Avodah of Yom Kippur, the sprinkling of the blood, was not on the Aron HaKodesh. It was the Eben Shasiyah. There was no Aron. The second Beis HaMikdash did not have many things that the first Beis HaMikdash had. It did not have the Aron HaKodesh. The Aron was not captured by the Vatican or the Babylonians. The Aron was hidden by Yoshiyahu, one of the last righteous kings, in order that the Babylonians should not get it. And the Gemara itself recounts stories of Kohanim trying to find the Aron, and they're dying, and later from they tell a story of the Chafetz Chaim, that there was a farmer, an Arab farmer in Eretz Israel, who apparently found the Aron, and the Chafetz Chaim said we have to keep it totally secret, and of course, the Raiders of the Lost Ark, but basically, what happens there, going over in gory detail, is more or less probably what would happen. So it's probably a fairly accurate rendition of what happens when you find the Aron, if you're not worthy of the Aron HaKodesh, right? Even in the Midbar, when it was transported, it had to be covered up before the Levium would be permitted to carry it, because of its holiness, one is not allowed to gaze at the art. So this is a very profound thing. So you see that what Chanukah is talking about in the symbolic level is the oil that was sealed with the chosem of the Kohen Gadol. And the Kohen Gadol is connected to the Kodesh HaKadoshim, represents the fact that although Yavan, which is the power of assimilation, ignorance, and opposition to holiness. But again, when I say ignorance, the Maharal says that doesn't mean the ignorance of simply being uncultured. It's the opposite. It's the ignorance coming from culture and faith in human intellect and pride. That can corrupt even a Beis HaMikdash, but there's an innermost essence that remains incorruptible. And that's why Yavan is 66, Heichel is 65, but there's a hidden Heichel to the A, the Tzeira, which is the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and the Shemen of the Kohen Gadol, who goes into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, represents that Shemen that cannot be corrupted. And of course it's important to recognize too that the Jewish soul is compared to a candle. Right? We light a candle for a yahrzeit. The Pasuk says in Mishlei, Ner Hashem Nishmas Adam. A person's soul is a candle of Hashem.
Naftamid
is now why is this so? Ner Hashem Nishmas Adam. So the Chiddush Yerim says, beautiful thought. He says if you take the word nefesh, nefesh is soul. So it's an abbreviation. The nun stands for ner. Now ner, we say candle. Ner in Chazal does not mean like a wax candle. But a ner is a receptacle. Like this would be a usually clay, an earthenware receptacle is called a ner. So nefesh is ner, a receptacle. Pei is pesila, a wick. And shin is shemen, oil. A human being is a ner, a pesila, and a shemen, waiting to be ignited by the divine light of Hashem. In fact, our job in life is to make ourselves a candle ready to receive the divine light that Hashem wants to give us. Our job is to, you know, fill ourselves up with oil, like the Torah, the mitzvahs, and the like, in order to receive the divine light. So in effect, the shemen that was sealed with the chosen of the Kohen Gadol represents our own neshama, which has an incorruptible essence. We say every day in davening, Elokai neshama shenasata bi tahorahi. The soul that you gave me is pure. Meaning all the averas that a person does, all the sins that a person does, do not go to his very essence. They're like dirt. In other words, they're dirt and incrustation. But you can wash that away. You can scrub that away. It does not affect the ultimate essence of what a person is. It is like a diamond that is covered with dust. But underneath that dust, underneath that dirt, there is a diamond that is waiting there.
When you say that this is the nefesh of a person, is that equated to the neshama of the person?
Well, the Chiddush Yerim is obviously, although he was a great Mekubal, he's obviously not using Kabbalistic terminology. He's using nefesh and neshama as equivalent. There are indeed differences. There's nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya, and yechida. There are actually five different levels of a soul, but he's not going into that aspect of it. Nefesh is actually normally the most external of the souls, but nefesh is often identified with what is called the animal soul. But nevertheless, I think there's still a relevant point here, and that is that even the animal soul, even that part of us that is involved in the most physical activities, can also be a receptacle for the divine light. In other words, we serve Hashem not only when we, as it were, separate from the physical, like fasting or whatever, but we serve Hashem even when we're in, or we can serve Hashem potentially, even when we're involved in the physical. So it could be very meduyak that precisely in the word nefesh we see this remnant of Ner Hashem. And of course, the Pasuk in Mishlei says Ner Hashem Nishmas Adam, which is Neshama. Here it says nefesh. So he's saying even the nefesh of Hamas, which of course was actually a main idea in Hasidus. One of the main ideas in Hasidus was that one can serve Hashem not only by what we call spiritual means, but one can serve Hashem even in physical means. I mean, one of the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov was that even people who were not learned necessarily could not learn Torah that much, but they could serve Hashem in the joy that they bring to their physical activity.
And the irony of the thing is
that Marzu,
Mazur,
Marzu,
yeah,
is a German.
The tune, yeah, the standard
well,
tune.
We should change
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Well, there are other tunes for it. It's not the only tune. But yeah, that's true. Mazur is a German. Yeah, Roe Shiva is actually a mistake. It should be Roim Shiva. Hakim Lanu, give us the seven shepherds. And the seven shepherds either are the Ushpizin or some have a different count. They count Adam, Meshuselah. These are seven great tzaddikim. So Roe Shiva, the shepherd of seven, is not correct. It's Roim Shiva. Give us back the seven Roim. Yeah. But there are different counts. They bring up Adam, Shem, Meshuselah, and others have the seven Ushpizin. Yeah, there's a lot of censorship in the end of Mosur, primarily because, as I say, because it is really a prayer for the downfall of Malchus Edom, which was understood to be the Catholic Church and everything else. And that was wasn't the easiest thing to openly call for. So this is a little bit. And the Aral goes on and says that this notion is also the idea of eighth is very important. I mean, we'll discuss this. You know, one of the famous questions of Hanukkah is that they found enough oil to burn for one day, and they therefore, but it burns miraculously for 8 days. So the Beis Yosef asks the well-known question, so Hanukkah should only be celebrated 7 days, it should not be celebrated 8 days, because the first day there was no miracle, there was enough oil to burn for one day. And there are literally 500 answers to the question, I'm not exaggerating, at least 500 answers, but there are Sfarim that are printed that give 500 answers, and there are probably more answers as well. But the Maral says, on a theoretical plane, there is something deeply symbolic about the number eight, generally. And he says, because seven represents the world of nature, because Hashem made the world in 6 days, and he rested on the seventh day, so that's a spiritual day, but that's still the culmination of the physical creation. Eight, right, the eighth day, represents something that is above and beyond the limits of physical reality. In fact, I think Thornton Wilder wrote a play, The Eighth Day. We're basically using that phrase, right, that the eighth day is the symbolic of new creation that transcends and is above limitation. Brit Milah is on the eighth day precisely because God's covenant with the Jewish people is over and above historical realities, meaning logically there ought not to be a Jewish people. The famous article Mark Twain wrote in the 1890s in Harper's Magazine, a very, very, actually very, very nice article in which he was accused of anti-Semitism for some reason. And he wrote an article about the Jewish people. And he talked about the wonders of how a nation that was persecuted by the greatest empires of the ancient world, of the Babylonians and the Greeks and the Romans, and all of those empires have fallen into the dust. And the little nation that they were trying to destroy still survives and flourishes. So the truth of the matter is that, in fact, Mark Twain said that Jewish survival itself is the greatest miracle that God ever did for the Jews. Greater than the Red Sea, greater than everything else. So the thing is, that is symbolized by eight. The covenant is above historical, physical rationality. It is l'mala min hafava. The Maral points out, that is why the longest chapter of Tehillim, which is 119, Kuf Yud Tes, Ashrei Tmimei Derech, and if you know the way Kuf Yud Tes is set up, it is 8 psukim for each letter of the alphabet. And if you look at the content of those psukim, you will see that most of those psukim are a praise of the Torah. They praise the Torah. Torah is connected to 8, because the Torah too gives us a vehicle of connection to Hashem that is above the limitations of the natural world. So therefore, Hanukkah, which represents the incorruptible essence of the Jew, that no matter what happens, there's an essence that cannot be corrupted, is a miracle that is above nature. Because in the natural orders of things, eventually you assimilate, eventually you give up, eventually you abandon your distinctive ways. And of course, many, many Jews have done that. But the fact that there is a remnant that will never give in is something that is connected to eight, because that is l'mala min hateva. That is not something that is subject to the rules of historical causality. So at least on a theoretical level, it's connected to eight, because eight is the idea of l'mala lamala min hateva. Of course, I once heard from Rav Lau, the chief rabbi of Ashkenazi, chief rabbi of Eretz Israel. He said this beautiful thought. He was talking about his own life for a little bit, and he said that I'm sure many of you have heard the story. He was a small child. He was in a concentration camp, and he was basically, you know, the Nazis did not allow little children. I mean, if you were 2-year-old or 3-year-old, they would just kill you. So his brother hid him in a sack, a burlap sack that he would drag around with him the whole day. So the whole day he kept this kid in a bag, and at night he would like let him go or something like that. And this went on for 2 years. It was just totally unbelievable. And he said it was a miracle that they didn't look for him. If they would have looked for him, for sure he would have been killed on the spot. So sometimes there's a miracle that you don't look for something. So he says, he wanted to answer this, that everyone asked the question, right? Why is Hanukkah 8 days? There was enough oil for one day, and if there was enough oil for one day, what's the miracle? So he says, the miracle is that they bothered to look. Because very, very often, a person gives up hope. A person goes into the temple, it seems totally desecrated. There doesn't seem to be, all the oil that you look for seems to be tameh. So who's going to start looking and digging under this and that and that and that and that? He says, the miracle is they had enough emunah in Hashem that they were willing to look. And of course, one could go even further. One might even say that the miracle was that they lit. Because if you think about it, a person might think, you know, what's the point? I will not be able to get pure oil for at least 8 days or whatever it'll be. I only have enough oil for one day. So a person might think, what's the point? Whatever I do is not going to accomplish the job. It's going to be incomplete. Why bother to start? Why don't I just wait till I can do the job right? So Hanukkah teaches us a very important lesson. That when you confront the reality of a world that is filled with darkness and ignorance and apathy, and you have the capacity to make a little light, but you figure, what's the purpose? My light's going to go out real quick. It's not going to make a real change. It'll light a little bit and then go out again. And a person might think, what is the purpose of my lighting that little light, which will really not really serve anything because tomorrow it's going to go out? But the lesson of Hanukkah is that you do what you can, even if you think it doesn't mean anything. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu blesses your efforts beyond what you thought was possible. But if you wouldn't have made that effort to do what you can, then indeed there just would have been that purpose. So again, it's particularly when we look at this, not merely historically, but when we look at it as the victory of the light over the darkness of ignorance and assimilation, the concept is you light whatever light you can light, even if you think it's not going to make a difference. Because ultimately Hashem will bless your efforts in a way that you did not think was possible. So therefore, even the first day was a miracle. That they looked and that they lit. That's also a miracle. But the Maral says that there are other answers to this. The Maral himself mentions the question. This question, by the way, is asked by the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef is the author of the Shulchan Aruch. He asks the question, why is Hanukkah 8 days? And he gives a few answers. The answer he gives is the following. He says, but the Maral says this could not be true, lahalacha. The Beis Yosef says that since they knew they needed to have oil for 8 days, they did not pour all the oil in the menorah day one. They only poured 1/8 of it on day one. And that day one oil, which was only 1/8 of the measure, burnt the whole night. Now the Maral says, halakhically, that would not be correct. Because halakhically, if you have a mitzvah to light the menorah every day, then you have to do your mitzvah completely. In other words, you can't say, well, I'll put a little today and a little tomorrow, because you don't know Hashem's going to give you a miracle yet. So you have to put everything. The example would be, I mean, let's say, for example, I had wine. Let's say I have wine. I only have one cup of wine. I know if this sounds strange to us. The Gemara talks about people only have one. Which kiddush do you use it for? Now, a person cannot say, well, I only have one cup of wine, so I'll use half of my cup, assuming it's the minimum amount, half tonight and half tomorrow, unless you're talking about diluting with water. Rather, you have a mitzvah to do tonight. Do it tonight. What happens tomorrow, you'll see what happens tomorrow. So the Maral argues with the Beis Yosef. The Maral says it would not be correct for them to divide the oil into 8. They vadai poured the oil, all of it, the first day. But the Maharal says, the miracle was on the first day as well, because obviously God made the oil to be slow-burning oil. Meaning to say, this is what he says, if you see that it's still burning the next day, a miracle happened the first day that it wasn't consumed. So in effect, the slowness of the oil was a nes that occurred on the first day as well. But again, other answers, as I mentioned, is they looked for the oil, they found the oil, but there's a beautiful answer in Hashkafa that is given. And that answer in Hashkafa is that the Gemara tells us the story of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa was a great miracle worker. And one time, but on the other hand, he and his family lived in extreme poverty. He did not want to benefit from his ability to do miracles. And one time his wife did not have oil to light for the Shabbos candles, and he instructed her to put in vinegar into the candles. And he said, the same Hashem who allows oil to burn can allow vinegar to burn. And this is what happened. The vinegar burns. So what is the lesson? The lesson is that we tend to look at a miracle as that which is beyond nature. In other words, the normal stuff, we don't look at as a miracle so much. We look at a miracle as a nigla, that which is open and revealed and supernatural. But in reality, the Ramban points out, all of life, we say in davening, only secha shebchal yamimanu, everyday life, is also a miracle. Except we take it for granted because it's the usual way things work. Teva is not something that just goes on by itself. Teva is also nes. So he says, the Ramban writes, the word nes means a banner or a flag. And the purpose of a banner or a flag is to call our attention to everyday life being miraculous. Hashem gives us these reminders. So he says, maybe the lesson of Hanukkah is that if the candle burns miraculously an extra 7 days, we're supposed to realize that even the first day was also a miracle. Meaning, the normal is also a miracle. A miracle is not only the extraordinary, but a miracle is the ordinary. And I believe the Chassam Sefer says, this is meduyak in the words of Ma'oz Tzur, because in the stanza dealing with Yevanim, it says, Bnei Bina, the children of understanding, Yemei Shemona, for 8 days, Kavu Shir Urinane, they made a day of song and rejoicing. So why does he use the phrase Bnei Bina? So we know there's a difference between Chachma and Bina. Chachma is when you understand information, when you get information. Bina is when you're mevin davar mitoch davar. That from one thing, you figure out something else. A chacham would have made Hanukkah 7 days. A chacham sees oil that could burn for 1 day, and the oil burns for 8 days. The chacham sees a miracle of 7. But a maven, maven davar mitoch davar, from the 7, the maven understands even the first thing is a miracle. That's why it says, B'nai Bina make Hanukkah not 7 days, but they make it 4 or 8 days. Again, there are many, many other answers as well. In fact, a simple answer could very well be that the celebration of the first day of Hanukkah is not because of the miracle of the oil, but it's because we regained the Beis HaMikdash. That's a simcha. We regained control of the Beis HaMikdash. That itself is a simcha. The other day is because of the miracle of the oil. Right? So there are many, many answers to this question. But the Maharal himself says, on an abstract level, the number 8 is very symbolic of this.
Yeah. Did it burn 24-hour cycle?
So here's a very popular misconception. People think they lit the menorah the night of the 25th of Kislev, because the menorah is lit at night, or Bein Arbayim, toward the evening, and they figured it just went without stop for 8 days. That could not be the case, because there's a mitzvah every single evening to relight the menorah. So they actually put it out every night, or every evening, and relit it. So it did not burn. I mean, basically it was continuous because they would put it out and light it right away, but they did have to put it out every night. Even the Ner Tamid. People make a mistake even with the Ner Tamid. People think the Ner Tamid means there was one light in the menorah that never went out. That is not true. It was put out every single day. What it means, however, is that it never burnt out. Meaning to say, the menorah had seven, not eight, right? The menorah had seven neros. One of those neros, either the one closest to the Kadosh HaKadoshim, or different opinions how the menorah was configured, was a ner tamid, meaning that even though it got the same amount of oil as every other candle, and all the other candles had burnt out by the time it was time to light the menorah, this candle never burnt out. That's true. But it would then have to be put out, because the halacha is, every single night, or evening, actually it's the first year, but every single evening, you have to light seven of the menorah candles. So, contrary to popular opinion, a Hanukkah was not a continuous burning, and even the Ner Tamid, which existed in the menorah, was not a continuous.
Is this Tamid too?
Well, we don't put it out. No, I mean, the minute of a show is we have a Tamid, but...
electricity now is on.
Yeah.
But we have also Lechem HaTamid that also they changed every...
That was changed every Shabbos, right. Yes, it is. This is a halacha. The halacha is that we are not supposed to replicate in exact dimensions. That's right. The kelim that existed in the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the truth of the matter is that only applies if it's exactly the way it was. So, strictly speaking, when you have a menorah that's not the same size, you could be makel. It's not strictly usher if you have seven. But the custom is that for the menorah we are stricter, and we actually do not have a seven candles menorah. I'm trying to think. The seal of the State of Israel is seven or eight?
Seven.
There was halachic, there was a halachic discussion about it, whether that should have been the seal, since you're not supposed to make a replication. Because if that's a seal, that's only a picture, that's all right, but outside of the Knesset or whatever.
Yeah, there's three and one.
Yeah, our minhag is... okay, well, that's right. That's why the Chan... Well, the Knesset has... I don't know if it's particularly interested, but...
you know. Outside of the,
Well, but our custom is we are machmir even if it's not that. But that's why they say, you know, when they make scale models of the Mishkan or the like, or the Beis HaMikdash, the architects are told to do something wrong, make some deviation. You know, it's the way they do it. You know, we do this a lot with mailing lists. Let's say I have a mailing list. I want to be sure you don't copy my mailing list. And in litigation, what often comes up is somebody says, "Well, I didn't copy it from you. I just made my own list." So the way they test it is that they introduce a mistake. One inaccuracy, and if someone has that inaccuracy, that shows that they copied. So here you have a similar idea, that in order not to be over the aveira of making an exact copy, they are told to do something, a little minor detail, that's a little off. And that would be... Yeah, but you're correct. We are machmir. Of course, we're only machmir, interestingly enough, if they're in a straight row. If it's in a circular... lantern type row, well, they were stricter than they had to be, because since in the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash it would have to be straight, so consequently they're not machmir. But this is part of a general halacha that you don't make, although I saw in the Hebrew Academy beautiful models of all the kelim and the Beis HaMikdash and everything, very very nice. They look pretty accurate, but they weren't really close enough for that. I think there were enough inaccuracies, huh? Yeah, it's really very nice. Yeah, so this is that. So contrary to this, obviously every night or every Bein Hor Abayim, it had to be blown out and relit, because there is a mitzvah called Hadlakas HaMenorah, and of course our Chanukiah is eight, not counting the Shamash, which is a separate matter. So we should not have exactly the way the menorah was in the base Hamikdash. Now the Maral makes another point too about Chanukah that's interesting. He asks a question like this. He asks a question: what do we celebrate Chanukah for anyway? Because Hashem allowed oil to burn for 8 days. That's a nice thing, but you know, the most that did is a celebration that we were able to do a mitzvah for longer than we thought we were able to do it. In other words, finding the oil itself was not something that gave us survival. I mean, Purim, you know, the nace of Purim is that we survived. The nace of Chanukah is we found oil that allowed us to light the menorah for seven more days than we thought we could. He said, you don't make a yamta for something like that. I mean, that's like saying if somebody's in prison and they miraculously found matzah, which is a great thing, but we don't find Chazal say, let's make a yamta because you found matzah that you didn't know you'd have. So the Maral says the following. He says, the main thing that Chanukah celebrates, Chanukah is really celebrating the victory over Yavan. And not in a political sense, but the victory of the ability to keep Torah. But, he says, had there not been the miracle of the candles, we could have attributed the military victory to our might, to our strength. So Hashem, by showing us the fact that this little bit of oil that was puny and insignificant could go well beyond its limitations, is a reminder that that's how we have to understand that military victory.
Hanukkah is also the
dedication of the base of Mikdash, right. So he says that the Shemen is really a Giloy, it really reveals to us how we understand the Milchama. And that's why if you look in the Al-Hanisim, in the Shemona Esrei, you will notice that the Al-Hanisim only talks about the war against the Yavanim. I mean, it does say we lit candles to thank Hashem, but it does not mention anything about a miracle of the candles. It doesn't say, we thank Hashem because of the miracle of the candles. It does not say that. We thank Hashem because there was ma'atim, you allowed a small number to... Right? In other words, it all describes the war, because the Maral says, the real hoda'ah, the real gratitude of Hanukkah, is on the milchama against Yavan, and the candles were simply to remind us that it's not from our strength, that our strength wouldn't have been enough, just like the oil would not have been enough to burn for eight days. To negate to the idea of what is called kochi the otzem yadi, that it's my strength. Right, the Torah talks about the person saying it's because of me that I was able to achieve all of this.
And you're not few against many, till today we're always few against many.
That's right. Okay. Now just to mention, then he talks about the Gemara and Shabbos. Now the sugya of Chanukah is very interesting. Chanukah, you know, we have a whole Masechus, a whole tractate in Mishnah about Purim. We certainly have things about Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, which are of course Torah holidays. But Chanukah is barely mentioned in the entire Mishnah. In fact, the only time the mitzvah of lighting Chanukah candles is mentioned is in a very, very unusual context. In Bava Kamma, which talks about damages, it talks about the fact, let's say I have a camel walking in the streets, and the camel has bundles of straw on its back, and the straw extends from both sides of its back, and the straw hits a lantern that's outside somebody's window. And as a result, the straw, as the animal is walking, buildings are set on fire. So who is obligated to pay for the damages that were caused? Is it the owner of the camel because his camel spread the fire? Or is it the owner of the light because he shouldn't have lit outside? And the Mishnah says, normally it's the owner of the fire because he had no right setting fires outside. But if it was a Hanukkah candle, he's exempt from liability because the proper place to light Hanukkah candles is actually outside. That was the original rule. You lit the Hanukkah candle outside. You still see this in Eretz Israel. Now they have little containers. But the concept is, the Gemara says, that optimally the mezuzah is on the right side of your doorway when you enter, and the neros of Hanukkah should be on the left of your doorway. And this was facing Rishus HaRabim, facing the street, because of Pirsumei Nisa, because to publicize the miracle. So it doesn't even say anywhere you have to light Hanukkah candles in the Mishnah. Indirectly, we see there's a mitzvah because it exonerates you from damages. But it almost appears as if there is a de-emphasis of Hanukkah as a holiday in the Mishnah. And there are different reasons that are given. Number one, if Hanukkah is a celebration of gaining independence from a hostile occupier, it would not be a big thing, it would not be a big point to emphasize when you're under Roman domination. The Romans wouldn't be that happy about this big Independence Day Hanukkah festival. Others say too that Hanukkah in a sense has a tragic ending, because on one hand the Hashmonaim fought against the Yavanim to reestablish the primacy of Torah and mitzvahs, and yet we know historically what happened was that the Malchei Hashmonai, they themselves, well, they were Kohanim, but they themselves became Hellenists, they themselves became supporters of Greek culture, they themselves became Rishayim, and in fact, many of the persecutions against the Chachamim were initiated by the later Malchei Hashmonai. And in fact, the Ramban also says that the very fact that they established a monarchy was an Aveira, because Kohanim are not supposed to, Malchus belongs to Yehuda. I think the Chassam Sefer says that since the Mishnah was written by Rav Yehuda Hanasi, who was a descendant of David HaMelech, he did not want to glorify the Cheshmonaim, who usurped Malchus away from David HaMelech. But it's a strange thing. It's similar to, my son is reading now, Animal Farm. So it's actually very, very simple. The concept is that those who try to overthrow the established order become the very entities that they were trying to overthrow. Of course, this is the revolution, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution. The United States might be a notable exception, although some would say not, but most people think, you know, maybe not the American Revolution. And that is, you overthrow something because they're tyrannical or whatever it is, and then you become the same thing you overthrew. Happens with kids too. Kids say, you know, when their parents did something they didn't like, they say, I'm not going to do that when I grow up. And then you find yourself saying, gee, that's what mom and dad did. You know, do the same thing. But be it as it may, the tragedy, and it really is a tragic irony, that the Hashmonaim became nichshal in the very thing that they tried to destroy. And therefore, as a result, the Mishnah said, well, Hanukkah is Hanukkah, but we're not going to glorify the Hashmonaim in that sense, because they as people failed. Now, I'm not talking about the first generation. Matthias Yo's children were tzaddikim, but the succeeding generations... Well, eventually they all died.
I thought they were...
Oh, no. The Malchus Hashmonai was a dynasty that lasted almost 200 years. This was a dynasty. This was a dynasty that continued until the Romans conquered Herod. Gorgias was actually a descendant of the Hashmonaim, but he was a slave of them. He was a slave, and then he claimed the mantle. That's correct. Well, the Ramban says there were two Averis that committed. Number one, it was improper for anyone other than Shevet Yehuda to be a Melech. And number two, the Ramban says there's a special Aveira in a Kohen being a Melech. However, it seems, the Ramban doesn't say it the Farish, it seems that this was not a condemnation of the very first generation, because there were no one else to do it. Matashele, I mean, they had to do it because there was no one else who was willing to lead. But what should have happened is, after they were victorious, they should have abdicated. They should not have continued their Malchus. That was the Aveira. In fact, in the lifetime, there was an official proclamation, certainly Matashele died. Matashele was very young, but Matashele died very early. Matashele was not even involved really in the wars. But they were not known as Malachim until much later, until really after the death of the first generation. They were not called kings. They did not proclaim themselves as kings. They were citizen generals who were leading a war. And, you know, again, obviously Kohanim were not supposed to come in contact with dead bodies either, but, you know, this was Pikuach Nefesh, whatever. I mean, they had a reason why they had to lead this particular struggle. But the problem was in continuing the dynasty. In fact, when the Gemara describes, you know, the corrupt Kohanim Gedolim that existed during the second Beis Hamikdash, how they would always die after they went into the Kodesh of Hashem, this is largely referring to the Hashmonaim kings, who were also Kohanim Gedolim. That was a little later. That was already under the Roman domination. Then the Romans started off, and there were people who weren't even Kohanim. But the idea of Tzedukim and Purushim, right, the Tzedukim, the Sadducees, were the people who denied the oral law. They were the Hashmonaim. They were the Malchei Hashmonaim and their confederates. The Tzedukim primarily came from the Hashmonaim, and the Hashmonaim eventually became bitter haters of the Chachamim, of the oral law. So, the Pharisees, right? The Pharisees are the bad guys in the New Testament, but the Pharisees, the Prushim, are Chazal. The Prushim are Chazal. This is our Torah about them. So, Hanukkah is very much of an irony, because it celebrates a victory that ultimately, even politically, the victory was short-lived. I mean, it was over 150 years, but eventually that victory was undone by the Roman conquest. So Hanukkah is a little ambiguous in this sense, but at least the way the Maral teaches us, it represents a much more global and cosmic victory of holiness over darkness. So even if the specific events happened and are gone, but there's a spiritual message that continues.
The verse is out of Perushim.
Perushim, yeah.
I know that. And the Perushim, the word means to see. Whom did it deceive?
Well, Perushim means they were separated. They separated from impure things.
Yeah.
It refers to a level of righteousness. They separated from tummy, things that were tummy. They were very careful in the laws of ritual purity. In particular, they would not touch clothing of people who were not careful in these laws, etc. Yeah. All right. Now, the Gemara in Shabbos describes the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah. And it says there are three different ways you fulfill it. Very interesting. The basic way, the minimum way, you're going from low level to higher level. The minimum way is you light one candle for your entire family every night. Meaning, let's say I have 10 people in my family. Night one, I light one candle. Night two, I light one candle. Night three, I light one candle. One candle for everybody. That's all you do. Then the Mishnah goes on and says, Mahadrin. Right, Mahadrin, if you want to beautify the mitzvah, you want to do better, you light one candle for each member of your family. That's still not what we do, right? What does that mean? So if I have 10 people, night one, 10 candles. Night two, 10 candles. Night eight, 10 candles. That's Mahadrin. Then the Mishnah says, but if you want to be Mahadrin min HaMahadrin, super duper, you want to be extra glatt kosher. So then we have a machlokes between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. How do you do this? Beis Shammai says, both say you light according to the days of Hanukkah. That's the third level, highest level. Beis Shammai says you start with eight and you go down. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Beis Hillel says you start with one and you go up. Now, there's an interesting machlokes, the Ramban and Tosfos, which is reflected among different Ashkenazim and Sephardim customs. What is the relationship between the highest level and the intermediate level? Now remember, the intermediate level was you lit one candle for every member, either you lit or they lit, but you lit a candle for each member of your family.
But they lit with the oil. How do they produce so many oil for each one?
Well, if you have enough oil. Now, here is the thing. We paskin like Beis Hillel, right? So let's put aside Beis Shammai for a second. I'll go back to Beis Shammai. We paskin Mahadrin. First of all, it's an interesting thing, you know. Even Jews who are not that committed to Judaism generally, everybody lights Hanukkah candles. But what's even interesting is, they don't just do the mitzvah. Everybody is doing super duper glatt kosher mitzvah, right? In other words, I never saw a Jew that says, well, you know, I'm not so machmer. I do the mitzvah of Hanukkah. I light one candle per night. Totally good. It's totally valid. If you light one candle, you make a bracha, you've done the mitzvah 100%. But who has ever said for Hanukkah candles, you know, I just want to be Yotzei. I don't have to do a Heder mitzvah. And Heder, I have to do two levels of Heder. Not just a candle for everybody. But anyway, but assuming that everyone wants to do like Beis Hillel, Mahadrin min Mahadrin. The question is this. If I have, let's take the eighth day of Hanukkah as an example. If I have 10 people in my house, is the Mahadrin min Mahadrin presupposed Mahadrin? Meaning that not only do I light eight candles, but I light eight candles for every member of my house?
Male and female.
Yeah, because men and women are the same. Or do I take the position that if I'm doing level A, I bedavka shouldn't do level B? Tosfos takes the following argument. Tosfos says, if level A is so you'll clearly indicate how many days it is, Tosfos actually says you shouldn't light for every single person, because then there'll be so many candles that it may not be distinct. So therefore, according to Tosfos, if you want to do level A meaning to clearly indicate the days, You should only light, huh?
At level three.
Yeah, well, I'm using A, because A is the superior. If you want to do the most superior level, you should only light one menorah according to the number of days. However, the Rambam differs with us. The Rambam writes that if you want to do the highest level, that also includes the middle level, and therefore, not only should you light according to the number of days, but you should be lit for every member of your family. Now, it's interesting in the following. This is an interesting paradox. The Ashkenazim normally follow Tosfos' ruling. Tosfos is from France and Spain. And yet, the Ashkenazim here follow the Rambam. But our standard, the minhag of most Ashkenazim, is that we have a separate menorah for each member of our family. Now, so the question is, husband and wife, is it different? That's a machlokas. Now, some say that although every child, every single child, at least at the age that they're able to light, should have their own menorah, but husband...
Even before 13.
But nevertheless, husband and wife, many say, only have one menorah, because we say ishto kagufa, husband and wife are considered to be one. Others do have a rule that even husband and wife light separately. So that is a machlokas within those minhagim. However, according to the Shulchan Aruch, which is the psak of Sfardim, at least originally, they paskin like Tosfos, that only the balabayit lights for everybody, and they don't have separate menorahs. Although, what do you? Because there are many Sfardim do. Yeah, one for everybody.
My husband lights first.
Just one menorah.
One menorah.
Right. That's what I'm saying. So this. No. What I'm saying is, this is the paradox. The paradox is, and this is brought down in halacha as a paradox. This is one of the rare cases where Sfardim rule according to the Tosfos and Ashkenazim rule according to the Rambam. It is brought down. The Taz brings down as an anomaly in halacha. But that's correct. The minhag of Sfardim. Right. The minhag of Sfardim is the balabayis lights for everybody. And if you're doing the highest level, you don't do the middle level. That is a machlokas, how we proceed. Now, it's interesting though, let's go on a little further in the Gemara. Let's go back though, in the machlokas, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Right? Beis Shammai says, you start with eight and you go down. And Beis Hillel says, you start with one and you go up. This is given as another answer. It's a cute answer, I don't think it's a real answer, but the answer is given, why Hanukkah has to be 8 days rather than 7 days. You see? If Hanukkah would be 7 days, you'd hit a day in which you could not tell the difference between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Why is this so? Because, okay, you have 7, 7, 6, 5, 4. Let's see. Then you have 1, 2, 3, 4. So the fourth day, they both would light four candles. And since it's important halakhically that we clearly show that we're following Beis Hillel, we have to make Hanukkah 8 days, so they'll never be the same number. All right, that's it. So Derek George, I don't think
that's the days before Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai.
I guess that gets back to the crowd. Well, I mean, you're raising an interesting question in halakha generally. And that is, what did they do? I mean, if Hanukkah was a holiday before the time of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, so what was the practice? Meaning, one of them is deviating from what the practice was, right? So we have to understand that they are really recording a dispute that predated them. So even though, of course, that maybe it wasn't decided. I don't know. It was Chayra until Beis Shammai Sodah, it wasn't decided. So I guess you're correct. Why would they make it 8 days? Yeah. No. Well, number one, it could very well be, it could very well be that until the time of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, maybe they were just doing the basic mitzvah. Maybe the concept of Hidur may have been added later. But then you're right, so does that mean the eighth day was added later? Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah.
Making more Mam Chanukiah, isn't it a law against Lotus Sifu Velotus?
Against adding, yeah. But here the idea is that since the lights publicize Hashem's miracle, the more you publicize, the greater. By the way, this issue, this is go back to...
So you can make it two Shabbos? Or you can make two or
no, Shabbos? No, but the whole mitzvah of Hanukkah is from the rabbis, not in the Torah. Yeah. And the rabbis gave you permission to make it as public as you want. Yeah.
I have two questions. First of all, I have to light candle for my children who are absent, who will not. I know that my daughter will never light candle. Can I light for her? I know my son will light, but my daughter not. Can I light for her?
Well,
she far away.
This is the thing. You can light for your children, for anybody, your husband or whoever it is who's not home, because he could be yotzei with the lighting of someone in his home. However, if you have children who do not live with you and they're not supported by you, if they're financially independent, you cannot light for them unless you're lighting in their home.
Well, if financially dependent, I can light. Exactly what happens.
If you support
yes.
them,
yes.
they are considered to be residents of your home, even if they don't live in your home, and you can light for them.
Okay, and that's a question. You told a few years ago that you need to supposed to light in your own house.
Yeah.
And if you stay overnight, you can light. But Shabbos, how to do Shabbos? For example, I invited for parties. I need to help to prepare for the Friday night.
Yeah.
I cannot light it too early in my home. And what where is supposed to light the Hanukkah candle?
Well, the best deal is this. Well, okay, this is an important point. People have to realize we pass in lahalacha that generally speaking, you are not yotzei lighting Hanukkah candles. You live doesn't mean where you always live. If I go to Israel for a week, I could light in my hotel room, but it does mean where I am sleeping for that night. So if, for example, I'm invited to someone's house Friday night, but I'm going to go home to my own house after the meal, it's very clear I must light Hanukkah candles in my home. Now, how can I do that if I have to go? So the way, of course, you obviously have to light before Shabbos. In fact, you light Hanukkah candles before Shabbos candles anyway, so you shouldn't, right? So the answer has to be that you have to light early enough. You can light Hanukkah candles as early. You can light them fairly early. You can light them, plug come in for that means an hour and 15 minutes. Well, it's relative. Now I would say around 45 minutes now before sunset. But they have to be able to burn at least a half an hour after sunset. So that would mean you'd have to use either Shabbos candles,
or oil. Table candles.
Regular table candles,
okay,
or oil.
Okay.
And it has to be long enough so it'll burn into the night. That's what you have to do. Now, of course, that creates people are sometimes uneasy with that because they don't want to leave candles in their house. So what I would recommend, perhaps you do, some people don't like to do this because they feel it's an ayin hara, you should light a yortzeit candle. There's no reason why a yortzeit, No. If it's,
Friday.
Just two. Yortzeit candles are the candles.
Okay.
You can use that for Hanukkah candles, one, two. They don't have to be a single menorah. And it's not so dangerous because, it's in glass.
Table, it's okay.
And it'll stay. If you're not going to, if you're not going to be in your house, you don't really need a shabbos. Well, you're going to come back. I mean, you could have a shabbos too, but I'll tell you the truth. If you have an electric light on, that's the thing. If you have an electric light on, you don't need a shamish. I mean, what's a shamish for? A shamish is designed because you're not allowed to get benefit you're not allowed to read or get benefit from Hanukkah lights. So the Shamash is an extra light. So the truth is, in our environment, we have a Shamash because of a minhag, but there's no real reason that you have to have a Shamash when you have a light.
Do you have to worry about Ayin Hara lighting a Yom
Kippur? I would say not. I've heard some people don't like to do it. It makes them uneasy, but it's not, it's perfectly fine. I mean, on Yom Kippur, many people light yards like candles. People light it for other reasons.
Yeah.
Right.
And what they were doing is the students were lighting collectively in the Hillel building.
If he is still supported by his parents and he's a member of their home. So the truth of the matter is, let's say a husband's on a trip or a wife is on a trip, who's ever on a trip, strictly speaking, if I'm away from town, I don't have to light if my wife or vice versa is lighting in my home. Now the minhag is that we do try to light where we are in order that we should have the mitzvah too. But strictly speaking, in a case like this where you couldn't light where you're living because they wouldn't let you, you could certainly be yotzei with that. But I just want to say that the issue of... Now, I want to raise another question, though. This is a little complicated. And that is the following. So if I'm going to someone's house for Friday night, I got a light in my house before. Now, if I'm going there for Shabbos, I don't have the light in my house before I go, because your house becomes my home for Shabbos. But the question becomes, Motzei Shabbos is a problem. In other words, I spent Shabbos in your house. I'm going to go home after Shabbos. Can I be yotzei just lighting in your house or with you? Because this did become my home. Or since I'm not going to sleep here tonight, so there I think it would be better to light when you get home. If you're going to go home the same night, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Shabbos candles, these are in a way two different questions. Shabbos candles is a very big machlokas generally. Some say that Shabbos candles, the main place to light is where you eat, because the whole purpose of Shabbos candles was to give you the pleasure of having light in the makom where you're eating. So many people have the minhag that they light Shabbos candles bedafka where they're eating, and that would be true even when they're sleeping at home, unlike Hanukkah. Others say, even for Shabbos candles, that they should light where they are sleeping. I usually tell people to light where they're sleeping. I can say that be better, but that is a machlokas. But when it comes to Hanukkah candles, it's very clear. In other words, they're eating in the shul and they're sleeping at people's homes, that they should light at the homes that they're sleeping at. Yeah. Yeah. And you're not, in other words, you're not going to be stopping until late Thursday night? Yeah, so this is a machlokas. You know, according to the Gemara, you're only allowed to light Hanukkah candles within a half an hour after sunset. Which means, you know, and according to the Vilna Gaon, the Vilna Gaon is very sick. He says you cannot even make a bracha after that point. But our minhag is not the way. Our minhag is that we can light with a bracha for the entire night, even 12 midnight, even 4 o'clock in the morning. And the reason that is so, it's very interesting why that is so, because you see, originally according to the law of the Gemara, Ner Hanukkah was primarily for the pedestrians to see, and that's why you had to light it outside. However, the Gemara says at a certain point in time that became dangerous, so we light inside rather than outside. Now the Rama says that also changes the focus. The focus, therefore, is not Pirsumei Nisa for the outsiders, although we still put it in a window, but it's primarily Pirsumei Nisa for members of my family. Therefore, the halacha is, as long as there will at least be one person beside me, it is a problem with single people who are by themselves without roommates, but as long as there will be one other person in my home who will experience the miracle with me, I can make a bracha the entire night. And that's how we paskin. Although the chatchila, you know, one should like within that half an hour. Now there is a problem with a single person who does not have roommates, because then the only presuming nisa would be to pedestrians, and if it's very late at night. So they say the Shem of Soloveitchik, he says that in a city like New York, he says there will always be robbers and criminals around. And he claims that presume nisa can even be for the criminal element. But it is a bit of a problem. A single person might have a chiyuv to light earlier. Now there's a famous story, a beautiful story. There was a great tzaddik in Europe who was not the Rebbe of the Chafetz Chaim, but a mentor of the Chafetz Chaim when the Chafetz Chaim was young. This was Rav Nachum. I don't know if you've seen, there's actually a children's book about it, Rav Nachum. And Rav Nachum's whole life, he was only a shamus in the show. He was not a rav. The doctor wanted to do very, very humble work. He would chop wood and draw water and everything. And the Chafetz Chaim really cherished this person because he was a hidden tzaddik. And he was very much like the Chafetz Chaim, but he was not as widely known. And the Chafetz Chaim recalls that he once was with Rav Nachum for Hanukkah, and it was time to light candles, and Rav Nachum's wife was not there, and Rav Nachum was, you know, they're waiting, and the Chafetz Chaim says, you know, we have to light, the Lamagon, of course, was the chief source of halacha in Lithuania. So the Lamagon says, we have to light. And Rav Nachum was like, you know, had all the time in the world, etc. Rav Nachum's wife finally came, and then they lit, very, very late into the night. So the Chafetz Chaim asked Rav Nachum, you know, the halacha is very clear that you're supposed to light within a half an hour. How could you delay? And, you know, your wife could be yotzei with your lighting, just like the other way around. So Rav Nachum says that the Gemara has a shaila in Maseches Shabbos. And again, these are shailas that are real questions. What if you only have enough money for one candle? A Shabbos candle or a Hanukkah candle? One candle. Which do you spend your money on? The Gemara says you spend your money for a Shabbos candle first, because a Shabbos candle enhances Shalom Bayis, because we can eat by it, we can enjoy it. A Hanukkah candle we're not allowed to use. So Shalom Bayis overrides near Hanukkah. So Rav Nachalka said, if the Gemara says Shalom Bayis overrides near Hanukkah, even if that means you're not even going to light near Hanukkah, Kal v'chomer, Shalom Bayis overrides near Hanukkah if it's only a question of delaying. And he says that since my wife would not feel very good if I were to light without her, my Shalom Bayis certainly permits me to delay the light.
You want it to be early.
You want it to be early.
It's already 11.
Okay, yeah, I do have to go, but yeah. Yeah, this is a difficult question. The truth of the matter is that although Chabad lights menorahs in public places, generally speaking, it is certainly a good thing to publicize Hashem's miracle, but generally speaking, we do not make brachos. I mean, they make a bracha, but generally speaking, we do not make brachos over menorahs that are not lit in homes. The only exception to that is the menorah lighting in a shul. It is true. And that's problematical, too. It is true that we light the menorah in shul every night, and we do make a bracha. That's a special thing. The shul is connected to the Beis HaMikdash, as it were, and therefore we replicate menorah. But generally speaking, you would not make a bracha in a restaurant, which is sometimes done, and you would not make a bracha in a public place. But
so
the idea...
So the rabbi says they do have a bracha when they meet...
That's their pshat, okay, but I'm saying that...
They light it home.
They light it home. Well, they
no,
say
they
that...
They have a lighthouse. They have a big one.
Yeah, okay, but I'm sure every rabbi lights at home, too. But their position is that any type of lighting which publicizes the miracle allows you to make a bracha. And even though they live at home, or will light at home, they say they're being motzi, the people who did not light at home. As they say, it's a problem because, you know, those people are not going to be yotzei if they didn't light at home.
Yes, my experience last year for Hanukkah, we arrived in Paris, and our family was going to take the shul. Okay. And Hanukkah Tabay for that shul was exactly the night of Hanukkah, the first night of Hanukkah.
Right, right.
We couldn't light in the hotel because it would be much too early.
Right.
We lit in the shul.
Right.
And Rob said, it's okay.
Yeah.
The next night, uh-huh, we didn't happen to be at the hotel.
Right.
We were somewhere else in the shul or something. Right. So we lit again at the shul.
Right.
And then after that, we were touring. So I had to stop at the first hotel. My brother had the hotel where we were around, like, by the
right
time. So
right,
I lit in his But if I do remember what you said, we have to pay for the, like I gave him a few pennies for the candles. So I'll be upset.
Well,
it's my candles.
I'm sorry, you said they were your candles or they weren't your candles?
They were his candles. I arrived to the hotel and I said, can I light Hanukkah with you?
Yeah.
And that's
I'm sorry, so who's lighting? Who's lighting?
I am lighting.
No, but who?
Who is the
he? I'm sorry. You said.
He was my brother.
Yeah. Well, the thing is this. The thing is that you also have to make it your home. So you have to, it has to be a place of sleeping or eating, you know. You can't really be yotzei and lighting in a place that
but
you have no...
But my husband was home here.
Okay, okay. So, so he let... So if he lived here, you're yotzei. Yeah. On the other hand, if you had kavana not to be yotzei with his lighting, you'd be in trouble. So you'd have to have kavana to be yotzei with his lighting. Yeah. Yeah. You can be yotzei with them even without paying, because if you are a guest in their home and you're eating from food with them, you become part of their home. See, the requirement of when you have to pay is very rare. That would be if you're eating your own food, that somebody just gave you a room. Yeah, but if you're eating with the Baal HaBayis, you are part of their family. Unless the show requires
you not. So I thought you have to have like a ownership right?
Yeah, but the ownership could be by a gift too. I pick up the lulav, so it's mine until I return it. Unless the show says, you know, we're tracking it, of course. So usually I
Can I just ask you, for the time that the candles are being lit, what is the range of malacha that cannot be done or that can be done?
This is actually a custom mainly for women, more than men. Women have a minhag not to do malacha. It says that things that sewing is something that's not done. Cooking you can do, yeah. We made sure of that. But you shouldn't wash dishes, you should not do laundry.
You should not wash dishes.
Right, that's right.
Well, he's last only 1 hour.
That's right. But the cooking, which is considered to be a pleasure of the holiday, this is.
I mean, can you cook for Shabbos while the candles are lit Thursday night?
Well, you're allowed to cook. It should be for something that'll be eaten. You know, if you're making extra, you know, some of it should be eaten for Hanukkah.
The sichsuch between if you have only money for one candle,
right.
Shabbos or Sechag, doesn't Shabbos supersede? This is from the Torah, this is from the Rabbah.
Yes, but Shabbos candle is not from the Torah. Lighting a Shabbos candle is also from the rabbis. The Torah does not say you have to light a candle.
Yeah, but it's in honor of Shabbos.
Well, that's a good point, but the Gemara gives another reason. The Gemara does say Shabbos overrides, but it gives the reason of Shalom Bayis. So you see how important Shalom Bayis is. Okay, I wish you all a very happy and fair Hanukkah.
And have a nice day.
Next week is fine. Yeah.